On this episode of Monmouth Weekly, University President Patrick Leahy and I talk polling and how important it's been in the national conversation with University Polling Institute Director Patrick Murray. This is faculty member Matt Harmon. It's time for episode number 20 of our Monmouth Weekly podcast. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Well, it looks to be a very beautiful morning in what hopefully we'll have a nice weekend coming up. We record on a Thursday morning. This is Monmouth Weekly, and crazy enough to say, episode number 20 from project we started all the way back at the beginning of the pandemic in March. I'm Matt Harmon, joined by my normal co-host, University President Patrick Leahy. And today, our special guest will be Monmouth University Polling Institute Director Patrick Murray. Patrick, I want to say good morning to you first. And I would imagine that the last couple of weeks, before we really dive into it, we'll start with some Monmouth updates from President Leahy. But I would imagine the last couple of weeks, you have not gotten a whole lot of sleep. So thanks for joining us here on an early morning.
Sure, my pleasure.
President Leahy, I wish a good morning to you. And before we talk about the latest happenings with what's taking place with the university, I think a good way to start is just what the Polling Institute means to Monmouth and how important it's been to kind of keep the university in a lot of ways in the national spotlight.
Yeah, good morning, Matt. Nice to be with you again. And good morning, Patrick. Thanks for joining us. I'm so pleased to have this opportunity to talk with Patrick because quite candidly, it was the Monmouth University Polling Institute, which in large part attracted me to this job. I always said, you know, I'm sitting here quietly and peacefully in my living room in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, a couple years ago. And I kept hearing reports from the Monmouth University Polling Institute about this race or that race or whatever else was going on in the country. And, you know, I always found that quite interesting. And then when the search consultant reached out to me and said, you ought to look at this job, Monmouth University, I said, is that the place with the Polling Institute? And they said, yes, it is. And so I said, I would like to take a look at that. So I credit you, Patrick, for helping to bring me here. We'll either have you to thank or you to blame. We'll see how things play out over the coming years. But yeah, really, really proud, of course, of what the Polling Institute does, not only to contribute to national dialogue around really important issues, first and foremost, but the way in doing so that it helps to shine a spotlight on our university.
And here I was working under the idea that you took this job back in August of over a year ago, just so that you could say that I was president of Monmouth University during the upcoming pandemic. You fooled us all. Now we know it was the Polling Institute.
It was the Polling Institute. And the Shore had something to do with it, too.
Absolutely. You know, President Leahy, before we dive in with Patrick and talk about the Polling Institute, I thought maybe it would be nice for us to reverse what we normally do, which is end with Monmouth updates. Why don't we start with that today? That way, once we get up and running into the conversation, we won't be diverted at all from our attention of talking about the Polling Institute, if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. You know, as you pointed out, we started this 20 episodes ago back in March to provide regular updates to the campus on the state of the pandemic. So let me do that first. I'm proud to say I don't have a lot of updates for you this time around. Our caseload on campus is very manageable. As I always say, I take every single positive case of this COVID-19 virus very seriously because you just don't know how any one case could create complications, not only for that person, but for, you know, their network of people. So we take them all seriously, but we're way down in the 20s in active cases. Our university has become quite skilled at managing these cases and managing the contact tracing, the isolation, and the quarantine requirements. My hope is that with the increased testing that we're doing and the constant reiteration of the healthcare protocols that we have in place, that we'll be able to successfully get through this week and into next week. And then, as you know, all of our academic programming will be going online after Thanksgiving for the last couple weeks of the semester. That gives us a chance to settle the campus even a little bit more. And hopefully we get through this unprecedented semester sort of in one piece. So feel really proud of the work of the university to manage through this pandemic.
And in addition, as we had talked about last time, but it had not been completely decided or deciphered, that the spring calendar will be altered just a little bit, correct?
Yeah, in fact, that announcement's going to go out to the university community in the next day or two with our plans for the spring. And, you know, the short story is the spring semester is going to look a lot like the fall semester, a mix of academic programming, probably some reduced number of students living on campus, some reduced activity, although we are going to try to, I think, as you know, Matt, fit all of our varsity athletics competition into the spring if it's possible. So that'll be a lot more active than in the fall. But more or less, the spring will look and feel a lot like the fall did. We are starting the semester a week late. We'll get back that time by canceling the week-long spring break so that we can finish pretty much on time and then roll right into what is an increasingly robust summer session here at Monmouth. So we wanted to make sure that we get that spring semester in the most responsible way possible and try not to upset that summer session. So that's the plan. And I think we feel good about where we are, but you just never know. As we've said all along, those plans will change as public health protocols warrant. And, you know, given what you hear around the country, just don't know what's going to happen come late January.
Well, clearly we have the right person on as our guest today, and we can figure out whether or not starting the spring semester a week late and not having a traditional spring break is the right move, because I'm sure somewhere, Patrick Murray, there is some sort of backdoor poll going on amongst the university community to see if this is the right move or not. And, you know, you think of the idea of polling, which has been around for so long, and the Monmouth Polling Institute from when it began in 2005. I'll ask you quite candidly, have you ever seen anything like what is taking place right now in the current presidential election between Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
In a word, no. And I think, you know, one of the things I've been polling in the polling business for over 25 years now, and we've seen a steady erosion of kind of this idea of comedy. Not with a D, but with a T. This idea that in the end, government is supposed to compromise, and we still want to have that. But we're having a lot more partisan differences in our polling than we've ever found before, and people kind of digging in. And that kind of is why the reason I got into polling to begin with is not about elections and who's ahead or who's behind in a horse race, but really trying to understand about why people view themselves the way they do in the political context, how they behave, and what makes them kind of come to the table in politics, and you know, what sparks their interest, and also what sparks their particular political point of view, whatever that may be. Looking for areas where, you know, your own identity gets tied up into it. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing. I started out focusing on political psychology when I was in grad school. And I think we're at a point where that is much more important in terms of a kind of a framework for understanding where we are today than, you know, a typical political science kind of literature. If you come to it and, you know, people vote along rational choice. And I don't think that applies anymore. So it's an absolutely interesting time for someone like me who's interested in that kind of study. But it's also one of the most challenging times, because sometimes it makes it hard for us pollsters to break through what people really are thinking and believing. People are starting to put up their guard a lot more in terms of expressing their political point of views, because they're worried about how other people will think of them if they express them.
You know, when you think of it, and the polling institute here at Monmouth, as I mentioned, started in 2005, so about 15 years running here in 2020. But you said you've been involved with it for more than that. What was it from your background and your different stops along the way that led you to the idea that Monmouth would be in need of, the area, the country would be in need of another poll, because there are so many of them out there. But what was it that made Monmouth a place that you felt like you could gain the reputation that ultimately you have?
Well, I mean, I wasn't here at Monmouth when that decision was made. I actually came to Monmouth because of that decision. I was at Rutgers for many years. That's where I went to graduate school. I started out there working at the Eagleton Poll just as a graduate student. And that's, you know, I thought I was going to be a political science professor when I went to graduate school. But I was taking a lot of practical policy courses because I found that was much more interesting to me than some of the theoretical approaches in political science. And of course, Rutgers had a poll, the Eagleton Poll, which is one of the oldest university-based polls. It's been around since 1971, I believe. And, you know, I just walked in there one day and said, do you have anything for me to do? I just wanted to try it out because I found that that's what was interesting me in my studies as a graduate student, was a lot of the work that I was looking at was based on polling. So I wanted to know how it worked. Ended up staying there and ended up working and running the Eagleton Poll for a bit, and ended up helping to start the public policy school polling center or survey research center at Rutgers as well, before this opportunity opened up at Monmouth in 2005. And I think that goes back to a guy named Jules Plangier, who's memorialized here on campus in the building in where my office sits. And Jules was a trustee of the university, but also had been a longtime publisher of the Asbury Park Press. And felt that, you know, polling would be one good way for Monmouth to kind of put its stamp out there. And when I came to Monmouth, because they had a national search for the Polling Institute director, and ended up hiring the guy who lived, 40 miles up the road. But part of it was, you know, I had a lot of contacts in New Jersey. I was used to working with the press. And we actually had an association with the Asbury Park Press to do New Jersey polling when I first came here and started out. And that's kind of how we started. There was a real opportunity here because it was kind of wide open. What kind of polling institute did you want to have here at Monmouth? What did you want to do? And so we did a lot of public polling. We did a lot of early work helping out nonprofits and also some of the local business entities in Monmouth County with some market research, with some image research, with some needs assessments, program evaluations, that kind of thing, which was all in my background as well. But somewhere around 2015, decided to make the leap into a national profile. I have been dabbling with that in our public polling of going outside of New Jersey and doing some work there in 2012's presidential election. We did some, and then decided to make that commitment that that's where we were going to go, because, you know, we had this reputation within New Jersey, and there's no reason why we couldn't carry that reputation out across the country. The opportunity was there to do that. And what's great about that is it, you know, not only helps to raise the university's profile as a whole, but, you know, gives us opportunities to give students opportunities to do a wide range of things. As you may know, we don't have a social science graduate program per se here at Monmouth University. So the training grounds that polling institutes do in some of the other universities, we don't do that, but we do it for undergraduates and for graduate students in different fields. So we have graduate students and undergraduates who have worked for us either as interns or as graduate assistants or just as student workers from not only political science, but communication, psychology, social work, psychological counseling, computer science, English and history as well. And we find different things for them to do because of our high profile. We can do things not just, you know, running numbers and checking numbers, but also doing background research. How do you do that? Writing blogs. We have students who write blog posts for us. They take some piece of what we've done and apply it to their own area of expertise as they are, you know, working through their students, their studies, whether they're, you know, a senior or a graduate student. And so we have some, you know, great historical blogs right now about, you know, this is what's going on right now, but historically, this is what's happened from a history student that's working for us. So that has provided us the opportunity to have that platform to do things like that. And one of the things that I started a few years ago that I'm most proud of is we started this class called Survey Research Consulting, where it's usually about a dozen students, and I teach it every other year, or hopefully can do it again when we can get all back together. But the class is actually a practical class in that we have a quote-unquote client, a nonprofit, who needs some work done. And the students actually become their survey consulting team with my guidance in the class. So I teach them the precepts of survey research, but also how do you operate an imagement structure on a consulting team. And they do everything from soup to nuts, from creating the survey to giving a professional presentation of the results by the end of the semester. So we've worked for Habitat for Humanity, for example, doing a survey of a neighborhood that they were doing some redevelopment in Long Branch. We worked for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Monmouth County, did a survey of the parents of the students who are members of the Boys and Girls Clubs there to about, you know, the kinds of things that they are seeing and need and like about the clubs. So, you know, these are things that the students can put on their resume at the end of the day after they take this class, because they have actually done a professional job, and had that kind of real professional experience. So these are the kinds of things that we're able to do because of our high profile.
President Leahy, when you hear Patrick talk about that, the one thing that strikes me in terms of, you know, not just what the Polling Institute is all about, but how it involves the students on campus and the students of different disciplines on campus, which is so important to what Monmouth has always been about.
You know, I'm glad to hear that, because I was going to comment on that as well, that in a funny kind of way, I'm glad that we don't have a specific graduate program in political science. Because it seems to me, Patrick, that most of those student opportunities would then be limited to those graduate students in that field, rather than opening up all of those opportunities to undergraduate and graduate students alike from different fields of study. I just think that is a sort of perfectly emblematic of what we're trying to offer here at Monmouth, which is, you know, sort of the opportunities, the big time opportunities of a much bigger place, but to make those opportunities available to a wide range of students. And I think that's, as I said, perfectly emblematic of what we're trying to do. One other thing I wanted to mention too, Matt, based on something Patrick said, I think it is fantastic, as I mentioned, that it provides exposure for Monmouth University. But let's remember, what we want is the right kind of high-level, credible exposure. And it was amazing to me to learn just in my first year here that there are something like over 400 entities of some kind around the country that do polling. Scores and scores of colleges and universities have tried to adopt this model of doing polling of some sort in order to help them burnish their reputation. But only six, as I understand it, and maybe you can correct me, Patrick, but only six have the highest A-plus rating from 538, which is the group that rates polling institutes. Only six have that, and Monmouth has it and has had it for the last number of years. So not only do we want exposure for Monmouth University and that opportunity to shine a spotlight on who we are, but we want highly credible, really professional exposure. And that's what our polling institute brings. So for that, I'm very grateful to you, Patrick, as well.
Thanks.
Have those numbers right? Isn't it like over 400 or something?
That's true. Yeah, we're six out of over 400 who have gotten that A+ rating, which we've gotten for the past 4 years now. Who knows? After this election, it might go down. But of course, everybody's would then go down because we were all in the same boat in terms of what happened in this election.
I just jump in real quick? Like, sure. Patrick, what did happen in this election? Is it, as you mentioned earlier, that the individuals whom you are polling are just that much less candid in providing their preferences? Or how would you assess what did happen, given that, you know, I know that the polling in general has sort of been under fire, not necessarily ours, but polling in general has been under fire as a result of some of the projections.
Yeah, and part of it is simply a misperception of what polling can actually do, something that I've personally and through Monmouth, we've been trying to fight. Breakthrough with the media to do a better picture of the uncertainty that always surrounds polling and increases whenever we're doing an election polling. But, you know, I'll explain why. Back in 2016, we also had a polling miss. Everybody knows about that. And we did an autopsy in our industry. Everybody was pretty open with their books and saying, hey, this is how we did it. And a group called the American Association of Public Opinion Research, which is really the foremost group for our industry, did an autopsy and came up with some reasons why the miss existed, which included some things that we could fix in polling, but also included, you know, analysis that, look, 2016 was a very volatile election. One of the things that we were looking at in 2020 was that it wasn't as volatile, and that means we had fewer people who were undecided, fewer people who disliked both candidates simultaneously, which is something that we had in 2016. In this time around, you either liked one or you liked the other. We had fewer voters who said they were thinking of voting for a third party candidate, all those things that contribute to late deciding or late shifts. We had more enthusiasm this year for the election than we did 4 years ago. So we weren't expecting a big miss this time around, but I'm on the record I put myself on the record anytime I talk to a reporter in the last couple of weeks of saying, look, I'm looking at our polling and this is what our polling says. You know, Joe Biden is ahead in these key states, but understanding the uncertainty of polling, you need to prepare yourself for anything that goes from a big Biden win to a Trump squeaker, as it were. Because the polling, there's that much uncertainty in the polling, even though we don't see as much volatility in what we're doing. And that's because we're going to have record high turnout. We don't know whether that turnout's going to skew. And one of the things when we do election polling is it violates one of the first principles of probability sampling, which is you know who your population is before you start. We don't know who's going to vote. We don't know who the two-thirds of American adults who are going to show up to vote before it actually happens. And polling tells you that in order to draw a probability sample, you need to know who that is before you start drawing the sample. So what we do is we come up with what's called these likely voter models to try to figure that out. But once you start doing that, you start introducing more and more uncertainty. The fact that polling in the past has been fairly accurate over time is because things usually don't change all that much from the time a poll was taken to like the last few days of the election. So they're not predicting what's going to happen in the election. It's just that there's a lot of stability there. But if we look at what happened in 2016 versus 2020 and 2016 versus prior years, is that we've always had this kind of error in polling. It's just usually you don't notice it because it's kind of a little bit all over the place. In the past two election cycles, presidential election cycles, it's been in one direction. And that's why people start noticing it, because it was all in one direction. There was a narrative that said Joe Biden was going to win by a bigger margin than he did. Although when I looked at our last national poll that we did at the end of September, we had Joe Biden up by 5 points in that national poll, and he ended up winning by 4 points. So our national poll wasn't off. It was our state polls in the end. We noticed some things, and this is, you know, to your my long-winded answer to your question, Pat, was in the end, we started noticing in the last 2 weeks an uptick in people who refused to tell us who they were going to vote for that could have been skewed. And that's something that we can actually look at because we have the records of people who refused to tell us how they were voting. And we can see if that might be a skew. And when we looked at it as it was happening demographically, it didn't. But these could be people who were going against their typical demographics or going against what they what their social circle was doing. And this is that theory of the shy Trump vote, which really didn't exist in 2016, but may have increased. What I'm worried about is we're going to do this election autopsy. And I worry that we're not going to really come up with the answers as we did in 2016, because I think there's something larger at work. And I've been warning people about this for the last 4 years, is that this increase in our partisan tribalism in this country, where we're digging down into our trenches of whether we're, identify with the Democrats or the Republicans or the Trumps and the not Trumps or whatever it happens to be, has increased during this presidency. And I think in part because one of the things that I started seeing in our polling were questions that usually had nothing to do with partisanship in terms of the way people answered it, suddenly lining up along with people's partisan identities, whether we ask them whether their financial situation at home is stable or if they're struggling or improving. That's a question that had limited correlation with partisanship in the past, but started to really correlate very heavily with partisanship. And we noticed it when the pandemic hit, because people were telling us, oh, somebody in my household or a breadwinner in our household has lost their job. Our income has gone down. And then we ask them whether they're stable or struggling, they're going to give us an answer that's more in line with their political views in terms of how it looks for their party or their side, rather than how it actually reflects their own perceptions. We asked that in a question. We asked people whether they were planning a vacation. And we got these incredible partisan splits because they didn't want to, if they had to say that they were going to cancel the vacation. We had Democrats who increased the number who really were going to plan a vacation went up than it really is, simply because they could say that they canceled that vacation. And we had Republicans who said it went down. So we had on both sides, we had people basically lying about whether they're planning a vacation because of how that would look or be perceived in terms of its reflection on the political world. Another thing that we've been seeing is something that we know all along in polling, is that we can't measure objects that have to do with social desirability. Meaning that, if there's like this kind of norm out there that people know that society expects them to hold to, that they, when we poll them about that, they might not give honest answers because of how their answer to that question will reflect on them. So there's, questions about religion, questions about race, all these things we have to be very careful about when we're asking people their opinion of, because we know that there's a social desirability bias in the way people will answer that question. What we started seeing over the last 4 years is that bias started applying to the president himself. And when we asked the simple question of, do you approve or disapprove of the job that the president is doing? For past presidents, that simply meant that, his policies, overall approach, whatever it was, that's how people answered the question. And there were certainly people who dug in partisan-wise, but we didn't feel that people were embarrassed or felt that somehow their answer would reflect upon them negatively if they gave it. And we started seeing that in some of the work that we were doing when we started asking that question about President Trump. So he's actually kind of changed the dynamic of how we measure public opinion, not just for elections and for 2020, but for other things as well. And I think in our industry, that's something that we need to be a lot more concerned about. Have we now gotten into this phase where people view their political views through a lens in which they have to be much more careful about what they say to others because of how others will view them? And that makes it harder for us to break through that kind of wall that they've created in order for us to get an honest answer about that. And I think we're going to spend a lot more time looking at that if we really want to make sure that polling is working than worrying as much about the size of this particular election miss.
It is Monmouth Weekly, episode number 20. Your host, Matt Harmon, University President Patrick Leahy, and University Polling Institute Director Patrick Murray, talking about a variety of issues. Patrick, I want to ask you this from a perspective of whether it's you, those who work with you at the Polling Institute, but I'm sure ultimately it's you that looks at all of them. How do you pose a question looking for whatever the answer might be, but keep the word bias out of it. Because I'd have to imagine, and I spent some time last night and again this morning looking at that 538 pollster rankings, and there's a bias measure in there as well. Mm-hmm. Monmouth is pretty close to zero, but there are some that are very skewed, whether it's Republican, Democrat. But how do you frame a question so that people don't look at it and say, oh, that's a biased question? They're just looking for whatever the answer is that they're trying to figure on.
Sure. So the bias measurement in 538 has to do with, you know, kind of where do you tend to show up on election polling? It's from year to year, it changes. So we've gone from a slight Republican to a, you know, no bias to a slight Democrat. I mean, that shifts around from election to election. What you're looking at is some of them, as you mentioned, have big biases. So you know you're going to take them with a grain of salt. But the question that you asked, which is a different measurement, is how do we ask a question that's not going to introduce bias, that's going to try to get people to give their honest answer. And, you know, there's an art form to wording a question in the polls. And in fact, I tell the media, anytime journalists report on a polling question about an issue, like legalizing marijuana, say, you have to look at the way the question was wording. Most of them won't do that. They'll look at the things that they were told to look at, which is, what's the margin of error for the poll? What's this? And so all those things line up. So this poll must be good. I said, no, you have to look at how the question was actually worded. Did the question introduce information or frame the topic in a way that would suggest to the respondent who's on the phone taking the poll that there's a right answer or a wrong answer to this question? And that's what you have to do when you frame a question about a policy issue, is give people the opportunity to say, you know, there is no right answer to this question. Your opinion is the only answer that I'm thinking in. And whether your opinion is approve or disapprove or agree or disagree, whatever it happens to be, that's a valid answer on either side, that there's no judgment of what your answer is going to be. So that's one thing that we really try to pay close attention to, that we're not introducing some piece of information that would suggest to the people that we poll that one answer is quote unquote better than another. Another thing that you have to be careful of is not introducing information into the question that people don't have. And I'll give you an example of this that happened in a Senate race that I polled many, many moons ago, is that there was a senator in his 80s who was running for re-election. And we were finding that most people were saying that his age didn't matter to them. When we asked, we said, you know, is so-and-so too old to effectively serve as a U.S. senator? And, you know, only about one third said yes. Well, another academic based pollster who will rename nameless was consistently finding a majority of voters in the same state said that this person was too old. The difference between their question and my question is that their question started out with, at age 84, is this senator too old to be effective? Whereas my question didn't mention the age at all. So, you know, the media loved to run with that other poll number because it said a majority said that this is going to be an issue in the election. And I said, no, it's not. And the reason why is because most voters didn't know how old this senator was. In fact, I followed up our poll question with another question, which says, oh, by the way, how old do you think the senator is? And the average age was 10 years younger than he actually was. That was the average guess. And that's why they didn't think he was too old. So the other poll was an erroneous measurement of public opinion, because 100% of the people in that poll knew the age of that senator because the pollster told them. In our poll, we got a much lower number because we didn't introduce that information, and we found that only about a quarter of those voters out there in the real world didn't know, knew how old that senator was. And that was, you know, a key. Are you measuring public opinion as it exists, or are you measuring public opinion if 100% of the public had this piece of information? And that's what I try to get through to the media who cover us, is that you really have to pay close attention to what the pollster might be introducing and what they're actually measuring. Are they measuring public opinion as it exists right now, or are they measuring public opinion under this hypothetical situation if people thought about this issue in a certain way?
President Leahy, I'm curious to know how often, if you could share, how often do you talk with Patrick about the different polls that maybe Monmouth does and the results. Are you ever struck by what you see on Twitter and on social media to the point where maybe you pick up the phone and say, "Wow, that was a good one."
No, we don't get a chance to talk enough, Patrick. So I hope our relationship develops as time goes on. But
yes, I know you've been a little busy over the past 7 or 8 months.
But part of it too is, I want to make sure that Patrick knows he's got the independence that he needs. I mean, he doesn't need the president calling him and suggesting polling questions and all that. I follow very closely. I of course get all of the releases, and I follow very closely what Patrick is reporting, and I find it fascinating. I mean, and then I'm so comforted by the fact that the New York Times often picks it up, and the Washington Post, and the LA Times, and MSNBC, and everyone. I mean, that not only is the information itself fascinating to me, maybe it's because I'm in part a political junkie, but also the traction that it gets in major media outlets across the country, including Monmouth Weekly. I mean, a major media outlet here on this podcast.
That is correct. We've got we have the pulse of the people, without question.
So I hope Patrick knows, I sit idly by on the sidelines applauding everything that happens at the Polling Institute. But again, want to make sure that we're doing what we can to support what he does from an institutional standpoint. But I don't want him to feel that we're interfering in any way, with his polling program. So that's the sort of integration we're trying to create here.
Patrick, I've got two things I'd like to finish with, and if President Leahy has anything that he wants to add, obviously he can. What's the best, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, and I'll say it in its simplest form. What's the best compliment that the Monmouth University Polling Institute has gotten? Is it the A-plus rating, or is it the fact, as President Leahy just mentioned, you get mentioned in the New York Times, the LA Times, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, whatever viewing spot or whatever readership that you'd want to be associated with, Monmouth has been there. What's the gold standard for you in terms of the Monmouth Polling Institute?
Well, I think some of the best feedback or some of the most satisfying is from my peers who I respect. Some of the top organizations, some of those other A-plus organizations, come to us and say, "Well, I really liked your approach on how you tried to ask about this issue. I really like the way that you frame, what's going on here and try to add some analysis that's not just, the typical who's ahead, who's behind in a horse race, but actually, the way you ask a question or the way you look at the data and try to draw a larger story out of it." So those things that you don't hear about, but I hear about from my peers is certainly satisfying. When the media come to me, not because they just want, a quick hit on what's, the horse race numbers are or the job approval ratings are, but they actually want an analysis of what's going on, including with the polling industry itself. They know that they're going to get an honest answer from me. When we have a miss, I'm the first one to raise my hand and say, "Hey, we missed this and we need to take a look at this. And this is why. And this is why it's important." And it's important not just because of our reputation and whether people trust or distrust polling around elections, because all these people right now who are crying about the election results being off and they'll never trust a poll again, they're the first ones who are going to look at the next poll that comes out. So I take that with a grain of salt. In the outside world, that's what that's what's most satisfying to me when I hear from my own peers. Internally in the university, what's satisfying to me, because we have a lot of other things that are going on here, and my staff, in addition to supporting what our public role is, they support our students and keep our students on track. They also support faculty and other students who are doing all sorts of research out there that need support, you know, doing online surveys and maybe some advice or going into classes and, you know, giving lectures on research methods and survey research methods. And, you know, I'm not able to do a lot of that. They have to do that. So I really want to give a shout out and of appreciation to my team of Carolyn, Tina, and Vicky, who have always made this thing run, but particularly over the last 8 months, you know, as soon as, you know, we shut down at the university back in March, you know, my team did not miss a beat. We kept going and rolling as if nothing, you know, if you were looking at from the outside world, you would have thought nothing had changed in terms of what we were doing. And so, you know, I'm really thankful for that core team that I have at the Polling Institute, you know, for making this just a seamless operation during this past 8 months in particular.
And then the last one for me would be moving forward. You mentioned kind of breaking down what worked, maybe what didn't work with this latest 2020 election. What's the future looking ahead for the Monmouth Polling Institute?
I think we're going to take a lot of a deeper dive into what is actually going on in the public in terms of our partisan divide and understanding what this means for us as a public. You know, can the Republic stand? What kind of public trust does the Republic need in order to survive and to thrive? Are we able to get that back? Because it does seem in our polling that we've lost that, but that people still, you know, are able to kind of voice those words that give support. You know, they want compromise. They want, you know, they want government to work. I mean, this is what we keep telling them. They want government to work. The problem is those in power, you know, hear those voices and take them seriously. And that's what I want to try to kind of measure. Because when I got into polling, public polling, you know, the thing that I wanted to do, and I think it's on our webpage as kind of part of our mission, is that to make sure the voice of the people is at the table when our political leaders are making decisions, when our public leaders are making decisions and thinking about things and really take those voices seriously. And that's what we do as pollsters the best, is give those voices a force of their own that they might not otherwise have. And so hopefully that we'll continue to do that and take a higher profile and moving forward and trying to help kind of move this country forward as well.
President Leahy, final word from you, sir?
Just a couple things. I'm so glad to hear Patrick talk about where our efforts are going to focus in the future, because, you know, here we are, what, 250 years into it as a country, and we're still figuring it out, it seems to me, and we need to try to dig into how can we make this democracy work even more efficiently for all of us Americans, and I think we're at a critical juncture in that experiment, so I'm thrilled to hear that. The other thing is so satisfying to me to hear Patrick say is that the great compliment is, you know, gaining the respect of his peers. And I think there are a few things more satisfying than gaining the respect of your peers. And I appreciate you saying that, Patrick. That coupled with all the things that you said, Matt, about the A+ rating and all the recognition that we get, I think, again, it's very satisfying for me as the president. I just want to share a quick anecdote to finish, and that is, I don't know when it was. Maybe you remember, Patrick, way back in the last spring or something, NJBiz came out with its Education Power 50, I guess. And I was home one evening, and my 14-year-old son saw on one of his social media feeds that His dad, his old man, me, I was named in that whatever it is, the Education 50 in the state of New Jersey, and so we had, you know, a little chuckle about that. And he's scrolling through the list, and he sees at number 10, way above where wherever I was, Patrick Murray, and my 14-year-old son says, who's Patrick Murray? And I said, oh, he works at Monmouth. He directs our polling institute. And he said, isn't that a little embarrassing for you, Dad, that he outranks you in this listing? And I said, no, not at all. I mean, he's a treasure here at Monmouth, and he's been at it a lot longer than I have, and he has a lot more standing in the state than I do. So, no, it doesn't embarrass me at all. So I just wanted you to hear that directly from me, Patrick, that even the youngest in my house now understands my relative position, my relative standing to you. So I think that's yet another way that the state recognizes the incredible contributions that not only the Monmouth Polling Institute makes, but that you personally make to our state. So congratulations to you on that recognition.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Nothing like being brought back to earth by your teenage son. I can relate very well. President Leahy, as always, appreciate your time here this morning. Patrick Murray, the director of the Monmouth Polling Institute. This was fascinating stuff. Feel like we, I'm sure at some point we'll be able to do this again and not have to wait 4 years to do it. But your efforts to get Monmouth in the national landscape and to have such a great reputation as someone who's worked at the school for so long and is a graduate times two, I applaud you for your efforts in terms of what you do at the Polling Institute. And thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
Patrick Murray, University President Patrick Leahy, Matt Harmon, we say goodbye from episode number 20. We'll be back after the Thanksgiving holiday for more updates going in to a busy December as Monmouth finishes up the fall semester, looks ahead hopefully to winter sports and the spring semester. For all of us at Monmouth Weekly, thanks as always for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day.